Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Currently available at Fright Rags, there's the new Stephen King birthday collection featuring artwork from many memorable King novels. Also look for the officially licensed Teen Wolf collection as well as the new Trick or Treat line, which features shirts, accessories, and even Halloween decor. I don't know if you guys saw that, but they created string decor that you can hang up over a doorway, and it features all the characters.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really cool. And don't forget about the Predator line, which includes both shirts and masks. Head on over to fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, at SUMMERSHOCK10 for 10% off your entire order. Head on over to fright-rags.com now.
This week's episode is also brought to you by RLJE Film's new film, Sleep No More. A group of graduate students set out to prove that once you go past 200 hours without sleep, you'll never need sleep again. But as disturbing visions and violent impulses begin to take hold, the experiment turns into a desperate fight for survival. Hey, our good friend Bria Grant's in this movie. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Find out what's looming in your darkest nightmares in Sleep No More, out on DVD, VOD, and digital October 2nd on Amazon.com. Welcome to episode 115 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galluzzo. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
I'm here.
Our
crew has shortened. We got a little slow.
Well, one of them became a Hollywood director.
That's right. Ryan Turek is here.
Hi.
He made it. He's a big shot. He's got a big movies coming out and stuff.
Yeah, that's
kind of cool.
Yeah.
Rebecca McKendry was almost here, but she has officially begun her film. So
yeah, I think she'll be gone for maybe next three.
I think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, she almost popped in for at least this one, but here we
Best
go.
Best of luck, Becca.
Yes.
We're proud of you.
You can do it.
Break a leg. Direct the hell out of that movie.
Yes.
Get a cast. I think that's what she's still trying to do right now. Days before shooting.
Casting, baby. Casting. So let's see. What can we do? Well, you just like, this happens with Ryan all the time. He's like in and out of town between episodes.
I think he left during the last episode, right as we finished the last year, catching a flight.
I was literally catching a flight right after that.
So you went to Fantastic Fest.
Went to Fantastic Fest. We had Halloween play there for the U.S. debut.
Any good?
Oh.
I heard good things.
All right.
Good things. No, the response was incredible, and that was the crowd I was super excited for. TIFF was very vocal and very fun. It's a very classy festival, but Fantastic Fest is where it's at, and they put it on multiple screens within the Alamo Drafthouse, and
just
played through the roof, and a lot of people loved it, and I was very thankful for that. Jamie was there, Danny was there, co-writer Jeff Fradley was there, David Gordon Green was shooting a new show, so he couldn't make it, but we were sending him messages and stuff, but it was great. Malik was there. The whole team. Blum.
How does Danny react to seeing how people feel about the movie? Is he like just loving it?
Yeah, he's absolutely
a total different vibe
absolutely
from him.
Well, because I think he was the one that people were like, "What, Danny McBride?"
Yeah.
And now it's like,
him, Jeff, and David are over the moon about it. So
yeah
it played well. The crowd reaction was great, and just to see everybody buzzing in the lobby afterward was really overwhelming. Definitely overwhelmed.
Yeah, that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, did you have time to see some stuff?
I did. I saw a couple things. I missed the secret screening of Suspiria.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I did get to see Paramount Pictures' Overlord, which
the big
is
blockbuster
the
one, right?
Big. Yeah. So here's before I go into it, it's a really interesting year. We are debuting this episode on the day that Hellfest hits theaters, Greg Plotkin's movie.
Which is kind of like what we were talking about last week in terms of haunts and stuff, like
haunts,
carnivals.
Yeah, so it seems like this year is kind of about theatrical films that feature plots that the diehard horror fan has seen many, many times play out on VOD. So in Hellfest's case, it's people go into a haunted attraction
or like Funhouse, right?
Or
like
Funhouse. And then there's a killer loose or something bad happens. Hellfest has that on a much larger level, and hopefully we'll have a review of that next week because I'm going to go check it out. But Hellfest is about a bunch of kids who go to a not scary farm type attraction, and then shit goes wrong. Overlord is a World War II set horror film in which a battalion goes into France because they're going to take out a Nazi radio tower that has been built over a church. And so, I mean, it is the kind of opening sequence, which is the storming of the beach, is incredible. But it basically, they
I had no idea it was horror, by the way. When I saw the trailer halfway through, I was like, oh, what is another war film? I think I turned to someone and said, I don't need another war film. And then it was like horror.
Exactly. And that's what works for this. Yeah. So basically, they're going to go in, knock out this radio tower, and then what they discover underneath the church is absolutely horrifying and cool. I kind of call it J.J. Abrams' Resident Evil. It's got a lot of twists and turns and a lot of surprises, which I won't divulge, but Wyatt Russell is part of the cast, and there's a bunch of, I'm blanking on the lead actor's name. He's fantastic. I got to look it up. But it's a movie that just spins along. Not Bokeem Woodbine. Oh, Yovan Adepo. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. It's J-O-V-A-N. But he is amazing actor. But, you know, as a film that's kind of merging two genres, like you said, the war film and the horror film, it does it really well.
Because a lot haven't, eh? Like The Keep, Michael Mann's The Keep's obviously kind of an interesting...
Well, yeah, there's The Keep, and then there's Death Watch, and then...
Devil's Rock from New Zealand a couple years
Devil's
back.
Devil's Rock,
which kind of the Nazi thing.
So again, I mean, like, you're proving the point, which is, you know, there's all these kind of World War II horror films, I mean, World War II films that kind of bring in the horror element, and I'm talking about, you know, supernatural horror, not obviously the real world horror, but... You know, the movie's got a great pace to it. The actors really sell it. The effects are fantastic. It's really fucking gory, which is awesome. The soundtrack is great. You know, it's just kind of a worn premise. Yeah. So if, you know, I have not seen countless other movies like that before, I would have probably, raised the rating. But the execution's really good.
Is this get a release coming up soon for Halloween?
Big release. Big release. It comes out like 2 weeks after Halloween. I'm going to talk about the holiday, our film. But yeah, it comes out in like early November.
Okay.
But you know, the Fantastic Fest rolled out the black carpet, and it was just insane. Cool. They really, and from the crowd, they really embraced it.
I saw good things on Twitter right after. I was like surprised in a way, so that was nice to see.
Yeah, it gets November 9th.
Okay.
Oh, cool. There you go. Yeah. But it's a bad robot movie, and it was one of those films that was rumored to be part of the Cloverfield universe, and it might have been at one time. But it's definitely not.
They're probably like, this is good. We shouldn't call it Cloverfield.
Tainted.
Like that last one on Netflix.
But that was a cool surprise. That was a nice surprise because I didn't expect it to be awesome.
Wow. Alrighty, Elric, you want to do the next one?
My quietest horror weekend before the storm, I guess.
Okay.
You know, all this chatter of Chucky getting a spinoff TV show, there's still two Chucky movies I had yet to finish, because remember I was working myself through the Chucky.
That's right.
I had yet to see Curse of Chucky, which is completely where I want Chucky pitched, to be honest. Like, I gotta say, watching it, 100%. I was like, okay, I wish I'd gotten to it earlier. I don't know why I didn't at the time. Probably because I never watched Seed, and I was avoiding it for years. I ended up doing it. As part of my marathon, I got to it. But Curse, I really like the way Curse was made. I love the gothic trappings. I love Brad Dourif's daughter. I thought it was fantastic.
She's great.
She gets the only problem with it is the kind of generic framework of the characters themselves. Why they're there feels very worn. Mm. But the actual setting and the way Chucky acts, it's all exactly where I want the Chucky world to be, which is, let's actually make a scary movie with Chucky. Yeah. Let's make him sadistic. Let's keep it funny. Keep it with Brad Dourif. I actually really like, there's fun flashbacks bringing the character back into the series.
Oh, yeah. Brad Dourif as Charles Ray.
And so I really liked it.
He hasn't aged that much.
Try to fuse it to the old footage is a little tricky. Right. But no, if like me, for some reason, you haven't seen the last two, I really liked it. So I'll go right into the next one now to kind of complete my Chucky phase.
Mm-hmm. No, Curse is cool. And what I love about it, which, you know, at this point, I don't think it's a spoiler because it's been out for so long, but I love Mancini's, because he wrote and directed this one, and he's been at the franchise since the beginning. how his, the way that he weaves, because it feels almost like a remake, like, oh, we're doing a new scary movie, and yet he pays off everything from every movie. Right. He always keeps it in continuity. Even Seed, whether you like it or not, is knotted in there, and you're like, oh, wow, all right, so this is a sequel. It is the next story.
To a fault, though, I mean, I enjoy the film a lot. Towards the end, it kind of, I feel like Don is trying to hit a bunch of check marks of, oh my gosh, I forgot to add this, and I need to add that, but it doesn't rob from the entertainment value, obviously, but it just kind of felt like right down to the very last minute, it's just like, oh, I'm going to throw in this little twist, and you're like, wait a second, now I need to unpack all of that, and where does this fit in this world, and
which is quite different than the tone you get in the middle of the movie. The middle of the movie, it's quite high-end in a way at times, like especially with her in a wheelchair trying to get around with Chucky, and it's fun that Chucky's referenced as, oh yes, don't you remember that doll, and the priest kind of remembers the story. Yeah. So there's some fun little tidbit. But the good main thing is Chucky's awesome in it, and it's fun, and the doll looks good. Doll looks kind of weird at times, but in a kind of creepy way. The face has just a weird vibe. But I thought it was a cool movie.
I think, since you're there, I think we should, I'm curious what everyone's feelings are, but no, not the TV show, the remake movie.
Have we seen the picture?
And they revealed,
there's a remake movie and a TV show?
No.
Okay, here's the deal. So, from the team that did It.
Yep.
Because remember, these are Chucky movies. So kind of like how if Friday the 13th ended up just becoming Jason in the name. So although Mancini is still working on a TV show and the continuity of that with Universal, what's the other guy? Warner Brothers? Or what company is it? I can't remember, but basically, you know what? I'll bring up the image. There is a remake happening already in production.
Orion.
I saw that.
Orion.
I saw the thing with Aubrey Plaza. I thought that was a TV show.
No, she is the mother in the Child's Play remake.
Right. Oh, I thought it was a TV show with Aubrey
Plaza. And since you haven't seen it yet, let's get your reaction on air.
Oh, man.
Although, I don't know how I feel about it, quite frankly.
The doll looks weird. The doll looks more like...
No, that's not an official page. Oh, yeah, maybe
right
it is.
Right there. There
it is. Yeah, so that's the image they released.
Actually, that's kind of cool in its way.
And a lot of people are not happy.
So Mancini's not involved.
He's not involved. He's kind of written it off. He's very vocal on social media. And they haven't found a voice for Chucky yet.
Yeah, it's a weird thing where MGM and Orion are just remaking the first one. Called Child's Play.
I would go with Bill Duke.
As the voice?
As Chucky.
And actually,
Bill Duke
once,
as Chucky.
Once that photo went up, this is what Mancini tweeted.
When
they revealed the photo.
When Mancini's tweeting, Mariah Carey, you know you're in trouble. It's a takedown.
It looks like they 3D scanned Jacob Tremblay's face. He looks like Jacob Tremblay to me. And then they threw like a Chucky skin over it.
Well, I mean,
it's interesting. I mean, like, I'm not gonna, being in the business of rebooting shit. I'm not gonna say anything. I mean, I'm curious.
Why not just do a sequel to The Boy? Because The Boy was pretty good. Like, somebody could make something good out of The Boy. I like The Boy. What are you making fun of The Boy?
Chucky versus The Boy.
I thought the boy had some extra nice moments.
I think The Boy would have the upper hand.
That's true. But I could put a twist on it. I don't think that doll looks terrible. That wouldn't be my issue with it. It's more just like,
I think the messaging, I mean, like, I'm sure it's an uphill battle for them over there, just trying to figure out, you know, what to do with it. And, you know, obviously Don's going to keep going forward with Chucky movies over at Universal. And then MGM's got this Child's Play property to play with. So I feel for them. And, you know, I hope that, a good film comes out of it.
I know. It's like trying to make two Joker movies at the same time.
Or remember Hannibal. Wasn't it with Clarice? Remember that? When Clarice Starling went out?
Yeah, but that didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen.
Because Hannibal came out first. They're like, wow, Clarice would be really stupid and redundant.
And maybe that could go back now, right? That could happen, right? Clarice could rejoin.
But now I think, now we're going on a tangent, but now I think the rights were everywhere else.
Split,
But I think now they waited it out where Fuller can get that character.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
So that's the hope. Yeah. But yeah, Joker, man, Joker.
I like that with the Joaquin Phoenix Joker thing. At first, it was like the studio put out something official, and it was like, oh, look, it's Joaquin Phoenix with a really crazy, you know, 70s haircut and these 70s clothes. And then everybody was like, what? We want the Joker. And then it's like, here's these set pics that got leaked of the Joker, you know, in full makeup and stuff. It's like, oh my God.
The suit looks awesome. It's the throwback to TV suit.
Well, it's Cesar Romero.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I love it.
I'm not going to judge because, again, you never know how these things will turn out. He's a great actor.
Yeah.
And he has the potential. Yeah. I just look at what DC and Warner Brothers are doing with their movies, and I'm like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah,
why is his name? Do you know his name?
No.
It's his name in the movie, which is never from any of the comics, is Arthur Fleck, as in A. Fleck. Like, it's like, are you trying to?
You need a comic conspiracy website where you just go, all right, I've got the.
How did you not notice that?
Insane.
That's really funny. The character's name.
Amazing.
Arthur Fleck. Affleck.
Oh, wow. It's just a hit.
Or Affleck.
Yeah. Affleck.
The duck.
Anyways. Yeah, the duck. Affleck.
Let's see. So, on my cue.
Yeah, what'd you see?
Well, I got to see it's a Blumhouse Hulu film, but a series.
Mm.
It's called The Body.
Yep.
And
Hulu Into the Dark.
Hulu Into the Dark. Okay, so this is a show, technically.
It's Hulu Into the Dark is kind of, it's a anthology film series.
Okay, so basically they're feature-length films.
They're feature-length films, and each one is a representation of some holiday that month it debuts. So beginning in October, you saw the body. One that's The Body.
This Paul is the Davis's first film. One. I went to go see it on the big screen.
At LA Film Fest?
I guess that's what it was. Yeah. It was at the WGA, whatever. Yeah. But Paul Davis is one of my oldest, dearest friends. We both started kind of at the same time in this part of the business. He was doing the American Werewolf in London documentary, Beware the Moon. I was doing Psycho Legacy, and we both kind of reached out to each other simultaneously to be like, have you dealt with Universal yet? Is there any issues on your end? So we've been friends for a long time.
He's from the UK?
He's from the UK, and he's been kind of, he's been just keeping busy the entire time doing little projects. He did a book on The Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. He directed some short films. He's always been pounding the pavement, and I was so happy to hear that this was his big opportunity to make a feature-length film. And so I went to see this. He did a short film version of it back in 2013. And the short is good. It's kind of quirky.
Oh, is it the one with the guy from Game of Thrones dragging the body around the UK?
Yes.
I showed that a jump cut back in the day.
That's right.
Oh, and, that's a good short.
Yeah, in the short. And what's your name? Pollyanna McIntosh, isn't she? Or am I confusing things?
I don't think she's in
it. I thought she was the girl in it. But anyway, that might have been another one of his shorts.
No, it's a really fun short. I didn't realize that was him.
So he did this short where, the guy from Game of Thrones is dragging around...
The guy with no balls.
Yes. He's dragging...
Spoiler from Game of Thrones.
He's dragging around a body on Halloween night, and so nobody realizes that it's actually a body. And so from that, I was like, I wonder how they're going to make that into a feature-length film. And sure enough, I was blown away. Because I've never seen anything quite like this. It's very unique tonally. Hmm. Like, it's much more dark comedy than anything, but when it gets dark, it gets really dark. But when it's funny, it's really funny. And basically, it opens with him doing the hit. He's a hitman. And he's dragging this body around on Halloween night. He has to deliver it somewhere to very publicly display it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way, he's kind of trying to outmaneuver police and a flat tire and all stuff because it's Halloween night and people are going nuts. And so a group of people are like, we love your costume. You have to come to this party. And so it's like the angry hitman who reluctantly goes. And it's run by Ray Santiago, the guy from Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Yeah.
He's like this crazy rich entrepreneur guy that I think is in the effects industry because he collects all sorts of monster stuff. And so there's this big party and basically the timing and the setup just keeps getting more and more wild as the night goes on. And I don't want to give anything more away than that other than I just had so much fun watching it. And like good horror, it gets dark in spots where you're like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this right now. But I thought it was really funny. He did a great job. And again, it's going to be on Hulu October 5th. So I strongly recommend it.
So searching
one
for
of my
that,
favorite things.
Can't wait.
We would search not for the body, we'd search for the series on Hulu, which is...
I don't know about that, because I tried searching on IMDb for the body, and it only comes up as Into the Dark.
Oh, interesting.
Episode 1, even though it's a feature-length film.
Okay. Huh. That's weird. Yeah, I think I don't know the exact air date, but I think they're going to do a big
promo,
yeah, and a lot of positioning on there. Cool. But Nacho Vigalondo did one.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, you'll want to keep an eye out for Puka.
It'll be wacky.
His episode's Puka. Yeah. But there's some really cool stuff in there, and their TV team is getting to work with a lot of cool directors.
Yeah,
so that's cool.
So I liked The Body. Recommended
The Body. Another one that I caught at Fantastic Fest was Gareth Evans' Apostle.
Yeah, that's one of the ones I'm most looking forward to.
Starring Dan Stevens, Michael Sheen, Lucy Boynton from Black Coast Daughter, Bill Milner, and it is a very interesting, cool movie. Very much unlike the Raid films, this one is a little bit more contemplative, a little bit more Wicker Man-ish, feel. And just to give you a little bit of the setup of the film, Dan Stevens plays a former missionary who kind of lost his faith after a bad run-in during a trip to China. And it left him scarred. And when he came back home, he discovered that his sister was... his sister went off to this island to join a kind of cult-like group run by Michael Sheen. And when he returns home, his dad got a letter from Michael Sheen saying, your daughter's never... Or no, he got it from his daughter. And his daughter's like, you got to get me off this island, but they're not going to let me go unless you come to them with a certain amount of money. Hmm. And so,
wait, was this set in the past?
It's a period piece.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so, obviously, the father is not in good shape. So Dan Stevens takes it upon himself to go off on this mission to go rescue his sister.
Hmm.
And once he gets there, he learns about this kind of cult's way of life, and you know they're very much of the. We believe in Mother Nature. We believe in, you know, keeping our crops alive and da-da-da. And I'm not going to go further, but there's a lot of really cool revelations that occur. And it's so funny because everybody's like, well, it's very different from The Raid and there's not a whole lot of action. I'm like, well, yeah, it's because Gareth is trying some new stuff.
Yeah. Is this at all based on his VHS 2, Safe Haven?
No.
Like, it sounds similar-ish.
No. Yeah. But it's very, definitely not. Definitely not. Very much in a different direction. But some good tension, great performance by Dan Stevens, some really grisly moments of violence. He definitely doesn't flinch from that stuff. Michael Sheen is fantastic in it. I was with it. It's a little long, but I really liked it. It got kind of a mixed response at Fantastic Fest, it felt like. And I think a lot of people were still kind of digesting it. What I really like about it, though, is that without getting into spoilers, there's some cool messaging at the end regarding Mother Nature and Earth and all this other kind of stuff. And I also love the fact that Netflix took a risk on a movie like this, because I think Gareth would have had a hard time otherwise trying to get this film off the ground. It's incredibly dark, and incredibly violent. And my kind of one other thing I wanted to touch on is that it doesn't follow any set of rules in the second half, and that's kind of what took me out of the film.
Hmm.
And you'll see what I'm talking about once you see it. But I recommend it to everybody. Please do check it out if possible when it hits. XYZ Films produced it. Really good stuff.
What was that Tom Hardy show that he's on last year? Remember that show that Tom Hardy was in? It was called Taboo. Did you guys see that at all? Kind of horror, kind of, but it looks a lot like this, like the aesthetic and the time period. This looks kind of like my kind of thing.
It's very much your kind of thing.
I mean, I love The Ritual on Netflix, and that was,
We should have we should have a larger conversation once we've all seen it.
Yeah, October 12th.
There's some cool stuff. Oh, October 12th?
That's really soon. It's on Netflix October 12th.
Oh, shit. And there's a trailer playing on there now if you're curious. I'm watching it without sound.
The trailer, they just debuted right before Fantastic Fest. I didn't even know about it. And I was like, this looks cool.
Mm.
But yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, wow, it's so interesting that Netflix is kind of gambling with this and Ritual and these kind of films, Cargo, like just some interesting genre stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And Jeremy Saulnier's film, Hold the Dark, also premiered at Fantastic Fest. It played at Fantastic Fest. I didn't get a chance to watch it because I knew it was just around the corner on Netflix. And when you're at these festivals, you want to kind of see stuff.
Oh, wow. That's like not
All the Dark is September 28th.
Damn.
That's
best. Yeah. And everyone is in that film.
Oh, that's today.
What? Oh, the day this premiered.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Hold the Dark is now on Netflix.
We can't watch it today, but you guys can.
You should have seen Elric's face light up.
I was excited. I was about to go home early. I mean, there's nothing I look more. Yeah, I've loved everything he's made so far, so this is exciting.
Yeah.
That's cool.
This looks like a big movie, too. It looks
it
like
is.
A big action.
Yeah. No, it's got some scope, and it's very it's beautifully shot. Oh, I'm talking about Apostle Night.
Okay.
Dark.
Okay. Yeah. But they both applies to both. Okay.
But I mean, it's demonstrating Gareth's, you know, his, you know, he's kind of trying to break outside the box now. Mm-hmm. He's trying to break outside what he was known for the Raid. So yeah, good stuff.
Alrighty. Elric, you didn't have anything else?
No, I'm abstaining this week.
Well, I'm
holding myself pure for the coming weeks.
Well, I got one more for you. This is from I couldn't even say it was straight face. I was going to say the great Joe D'Amato, but
on the heels of Anthropophagus.
I know David Greger will be so mad at me if I say it that way. So let's just say there's this film from Joe D'Amato that actually two films that have been put out by Severn Films. Bless them for always finding the weirdest of the weird, restoring and putting out. The first one, which I have not seen yet, was, you say the title?
Anthropophagus.
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 So that Blu-ray came out. I started watching that last night, but I didn't finish it yet. But this one I went right to, Absurd, also known as, according to my Letterboxd, Monster Hunter, which makes no sense whatsoever. Oh, actually, that does totally make sense.
Or Anthropophagus too.
Because Anthropophagus was known as Grim Reaper. Oh, so this is also Grim Reaper 2. This is also known as Zombie 6. Known as Horrible. That's not a title. I'm not saying that.
Wait, so Zombie 6, really? This could be part of our zombie...
You could. You might have to go into it.
I got
to
do it now. No, I would have done it anyway. I was actually looking forward to it.
Well, I love that David will put out Zombie 6, but not Zombie 5. But anyway, the reason I went right to this movie, which I'd never heard of, is because in the back of the box, it says that it borrows heavily from Halloween. And then I looked at the back of the box, and it looks like it borrows heavily from Halloween 2.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's absolutely a total Halloween 1 and 2 ripoff. If Halloween 1 and 2 were like a total, one movie, this is a complete ripoff of that. It opens with this normal-looking Italian guy, no mask, no nothing, running towards screen, being chased by his Loomis, which is actually the Dean from Pieces.
What? Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
The main guy from Pieces is actually the Loomis guy that's chasing him, and he pretty much stumbles onto somebody's house with his guts hanging out, which you see right there, which is a common motif. And apparently, once he goes to the hospital, they're like, no, you don't understand. He has this uncontrollable regenerative ability. You can't stop him. He just keeps, you know. And as soon as you find that out, he gets up and he starts murdering people in the hospital, a la Halloween 2. Uh-huh. One of them he may needle in the eye. Another he may burn her face off. Like,
Is it George Eastman or something?
Borrow a lot from it. And that's kind of it. I mean, it's a brisk. It's under 90 minutes and it's pretty brisk. And it's
so
just
no cannibalism. Because the other one's all cannibal guy.
I don't know. I mean, he's just sort of like a Michael Myers type, only he looks like a normal... It's almost like the awkwardness of, like, Final Exam, where, like, you expect him to be, like, in a mask or something. It's just a dude in denim strutting around. It's the same thing. It's, like, just some Italian guy. It's just...
When you're done with this.
Okay, I'll probably...
Oh, yeah, now it's going to
make the
rounds.
I'll do it this week, and then you bring it next week.
So I can't say that I love Absurd. I can say that the title is apt. Absurd is absurd.
Which did you watch? The English is 94 minutes. The Italian's 88.
I watched the English because it's got the gore on it. I want to see the good stuff. Yeah. But I think if you like the kind of stuff that Severn puts out, and in particular want to see Halloween 1 and 2 poorly redone by Italians with the Pieces guys, the Loomis, then this movie is for you.
Or if you're just a huge George Eastman fan.
That too. And you know,
I don't know him for many things, but he was in a few.
And by the way, I do like the score, and it comes with the CD soundtrack.
Okay,
so
cool.
That's always a wonderful bonus.
And Anthropophagus has a great score. So,
yeah.
I'll be curious to see what you think of that one. It's an interesting, weird movie. It has a couple really gory scenes.
I started watching it last night, but it was too late, and I was I'm going to start again. But I like the opening sequence and the way that it kind of kicked off. But yeah, so Absurd.
I can't wait to see
films.
I shall watch it.
Yeah.
All right.
Let me just buzz through a few other things really quick that I saw at Fantastic Fest. saw a film called The Boat, which is basically The Promise is Christine on the Water.
No.
Not so much.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I was kind of, I was a little disappointed by it. Level 16 is a great film, I think, out of, it's a Canadian production from a director named Danishka Esterhazy. And basically she created a film about teenage girls who are growing up in a kind of prison-like boarding school, and they're all being groomed to be the perfect woman. So you have to be proper, you have to be polite, you have to abide by certain cleansing rituals and all this stuff. And meanwhile, all these girls think they're going to get adopted. And then along the way, they discover there's a darker purpose fueling this school.
Yeah, this one was being compared to Gaspar Noé's ex-girlfriend made a film. She made that movie Evolution a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
A movie I loved before that called Innocence, which I'm a huge fan of. It's all about a girls at a boarding school. Shot kind of like Suspiria.
Wait a minute. This was the one on the island?
Yeah. The film she made before that one film called Innocence, like 8 years before, and it looks a lot like Suspiria. Yeah. It's all little girls at a boarding school that could also be the afterlife. Mm. It's a really great movie.
I've never seen it.
Kind of harder to get here, but I heard some comparisons to that in terms of like the world.
So. Yeah, it's really, really good. It's a great first feature film for Danishka. Really great photography, great performances. I thought all the girls were really good. I think that there are just a few logic gaps that I bumped on, but solid film. Another one I want to talk about really quick is One Cut of the Dead, which is a Japanese horror comedy.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about this one.
Movie is a laugh riot.
No, I don't know.
Hilarious.
Okay.
It begins as a film about a film crew trying to shoot a zombie movie until real zombies show up and then hijinks ensue. And you're like, okay. And it's all told in one shot. And you're like, okay, I've seen this before. This is amusing. It's really funny. And then at the 37-minute mark, the credits start rolling on the zombie movie. And you're like, wait a second, that was really short. What a fun experience. Okay. And when the credits stop, then you're introduced to this director who is meeting a bunch of network executives who are saying, okay, we want to hire you to do a one-shot zombie film that's going to be a TV event. Do you think you could do it? And he's like, oh, well, he's got a family at home. He's got an older daughter he's trying to take care of. And he's like, yes. And what you get is the making of the zombie movie that you just watched. And it's not a real making of, it's just the kind of fictionalized, scripted, like hijinks. It's like a Christopher Guest movie.
Oh, wow. Weird.
It's hilarious. Oh, my God. And so there are like these little callbacks because you're seeing behind the scenes some of the stuff. So, for instance, there's a moment where a zombie, in the first 37 minutes, a zombie walks up to somebody and pukes on them. What you discover is that actor was very sick and he's actually puking on them. Yeah. So that's as far as I want to go with it. But
is it like What We Do in the Shadows humor or something else?
I wouldn't say as broad and as big. Yeah. This one's a little bit more grounded. But at the core of it is this emotional story about a father who's the director who's trying to reconnect with his teenage daughter. And it's really sentimental. Huh. It's really well done. So the movie was made for nothing in Japan and became a smash hit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So now it's they're thinking about bringing it over here.
Oh, nice.
And then I spent my Saturday morning, and this is the most glorious Saturday morning, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I spent it with Maniac.
Oh, cool.
The Joe Spinell
one. I thought you were talking because there's
Not the Netflix show. Not Elijah Wood.
If any actor's sweat was ever meant to be 4K, Joe Spinell sweat.
I fell in love all over again.
How much better looking can it get, Ryan? I don't understand.
It looks very good, but I have never seen Maniac on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
And I had this theater pretty much to all myself because they were they did it during a P&I screening, and I missed the screening the night before, so I just woke up, grabbed some coffee, and settled in. I am a huge fan of Maniac.
I think it's a great movie, fantastic.
And Joe Spinell,
he is on fire.
But he's also charismatic as fuck when he's hanging around with Carolyn Monroe. Would you say he has poetry in his eyes?
I was waiting for that quote.
No, not just poetry in his eyes, in the way he speaks,
in his
vernacular. When he meets Carolyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And you're like, I can believe these two would actually hook up if he absolutely wasn't batshit insane.
Well, you had always said that you could take that scene of him visiting Carolyn Monroe like completely out of the movie and think it's from an awkward like drama, like a romance from a drama, you know, not a horror movie.
He would have been so good. good in Todd Solondz movies. Can you even imagine that? It would have been like perfect. Yeah. But and also Carolyn Monroe's gorgeous. Oh, I think she's got that quality that.
But there's just like there's just a vibe to them when he takes her out to dinner and he's just like he's just so frank with her where she's like, well, I'm going to be going to this thing, and he's like, well, there's going to be another guy there. What chances do I have? And she's like, oh, don't be silly. And he's like, I'm serious. Yeah. I don't know. And it's like, oh, dude, you're like, he's awesome. I'm rooting for you, man, but you're also crazy.
Yeah. Well, you know, in previous releases, I'm pretty sure there's an interview with her on one of these discs. Yeah. And like, she was super smitten by him. Like when she talks about him in retrospect, like I think it was,
worked the charm.
The charm was real.
Oh, yeah. People do say he's incredibly charming.
There's something about him that everybody loved.
But this, I mean, like the 4K really makes all the color pop and really brings Savini's effects to the fore. I mean, like, it's just a beautiful in the kind of grimy New York production sense. What's really funny is someone's got to do a video essay of how American filmmakers presented New York City and how Italian filmmakers presented
New York
City.
Ripper.
Yeah, because there was this there's this wide shot of New York City at night. And I was expecting the kind of whoop whoops you hear from the Fulci, like whoop whoop, and it was just it was just the drone of cars and horns, and I was like, that's the real New York, you know, not the Fulci New York, which I also love,
which is also Zombies also coming out in the 4K to screen. I'm going to see both those.
I'm
going
to have to rebuy these, damn it, God, I think I am.
Yeah. But wouldn't it only matter if you had a 4K TV?
I do have a 4K TV.
Okay,
but I don't have a 4K player, and I think you need anyways.
I have a 4K player. I don't have a TV.
Yeah, but it's good to know that movie's getting seen on a big screen again, because it's really actually underrated. I think because of the remake, less people have actually gone back to the original.
Well, I was going to say, it's going to be, if you're in Los Angeles, it's playing at Beyond Fest.
That's right,
Beyond Fest. So they're going to show Eli Roth's History of Horror episode, and then they're going to show Maniac right after.
Or come watch with me in Knoxville. Come all the way to Knoxville just to watch Maniac with me.
All right.
Touch Joe Spinell on the face.
Well, let's hear from our sponsors again, and we will be back with our very special guest.
Yes.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Currently available at Fright Rags, there's the new Stephen King birthday collection featuring artwork from many memorable King novels. Also, look for the officially licensed Teen Wolf collection, as well as the new Trick or Treat line, which features shirts, accessories, and even Halloween decor. I don't know if you guys saw that, but they created string decor that you can hang up over a doorway, and it features all the characters.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really cool. And don't forget about the Predator line, which includes both shirts and masks. Head on over to fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, at SUMMERSHOCK10 for 10% off your entire order. Head on over to fright-rags.com now.
This week's episode is also brought to you by RLJE Films' new film, Sleep No More. A group of graduate students set out to prove that once you go past 200 hours without sleep, you'll never need sleep again. But as disturbing visions and violent impulses begin to take hold, the experiment turns into a desperate fight for survival. Hey, our good friend Bree Grant's in this movie. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Find out what's looming in your darkest nightmares in Sleep No More, out on DVD, VOD, and digital October 2nd on Amazon.com.
All right, we're back, and we have a very special guest who was once on the show before during a bonus episode, but now he's got a brand new book on the way. We're excited to have him on. Mr. Grady Hendrix, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Last time we talked, I believe My Best Friend's Exorcism was coming out in paperback.
Yes.
Now you have We Sold Our Souls. Hardcover edition coming.
It's out. It's September 18th. It is on the loose.
It's official.
It's official.
It's a loss.
And Ryan, you discovered something wonderful about
the
cover.
Yeah. If you take the cover off on the hardcover edition, there is some ancient text. Maybe it's ancient. I don't know. But it's written backwards, so I actually have to hold it up to the mirror. And in its silver font, it will read me something. I don't know what it is. So
the art director for Quirks, this guy, Doogie Horner, and he's made this thing look like a box set concept album by like a Swedish black metal band. It really shouldn't look look this good, but
I love it. I love it. Grady, admittedly, I'm halfway through the book just because my reading here at Blumhouse is so heavy. But I've been reading more than ever this year, which has been great. I've been reading a lot of books, and this was in my queue. I'm happy to be getting through it. But the setup so far is a protagonist named Christine, who is a rocker, who is very unnerved that there is one of her former friends / bandmates is coming out for a farewell tour.
Yes.
And that's and then she just teamed up with two more of her other bandmates, and things have gone awry.
As they do.
Yeah, this is a really compelling read. I love the world that it's set in. I'm actually learning a little bit about some actual music that I've never, like some tracks that I've never heard before.
Oh, thank you.
No, there's some really good stuff, and you kind of get into, there's a great bit where we get into Chris's backstory and how she meets her best friend
Terry,
and them trading notes and talking about the best Iron Maiden music and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, I kind of agree with some of those thoughts. So very, very well done. Grady, let's talk about just kind of the switching gears going from My Best Friend's Exorcism to Paperbacks from Hell to, you know, fiction, like We Sold Our Soul. So where was the turn?
Well, what happened was my next book was actually supposed to be a totally different book after My Best Friend's Exorcism. Yeah. And I wrote these columns for Tor about paperbacks, like horror paperbacks. So I was just sort of like, there wasn't a lot out there. And I was just grabbing stuff at random and reading it and writing it up. And my editor from Quirk called and said, would you ever turn these into a book? And I was like, would I go to an island full of cocaine and spend the rest of my life there? Sure. And he's like, I don't know if we'd go for it, but why don't you pitch it? And I did, and they went for it. But then that was a year. And by the time I got back to the book I had been writing, I couldn't sell it. It was this book about, it was called Final Girl Support Group. And between the time I wrote the first draft and then came back to it, all the Scream Queens and stuff came out.
God.
And everyone was like, Final Girls, no thanks. And I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah.
And so then I wound up doing We Sold Our Souls because I was like, oh, it's this heavy metal horror book. And they sort of imagined, like, this is Spinal Tap meets the Manchurian Candidate. But the book went way darker and weirder than that. It was kind of a rough ride to get to the finish line with this one. But yeah, so that was sort of the progression, you know?
Huh.
Well, this one's great, by the way. But what it reminded me of, I am now 10, 15, some odd years away from my rock and roll lifestyle.
Right.
Were you ever in a band? Because I feel like you must have been. The way that you were picking on, like, stuff to do a tour and, like, meeting bandmates and all that stuff was very authentic I just assumed you must have been in a band at some point.
No, and in fact, when I was at NYU, everyone I knew was in a band, so all I did was go to shows and, like, help them get their gear on and off the stage.
Yes.
And so when I was writing this, I went back and talked to someone, this guy Adam Patterson, who's been in, like, more bands than I've had hot dinners, who runs a tattoo place in Jersey City now. And then this other guy, so this is a really weird dive, but in My Best Friend's Exorcism, Gretchen's house is actually my real next door neighbor's house growing up. And she wound up marrying this guy, Tom Youngblood, who's the lead guy in Camelot with a K, which is a metal band. And so he was sort of my metal coach, and sort of my concert coach. Like, he let me come backstage at shows and stuff and sort of see how it works. So, and then I just imagined.
Well, you nailed it, guy.
Yeah.
I was convinced that you must have toured a band at some point.
No, and I did take guitar lessons because I'm very unmusical. So I took guitar lessons for a few months to write this, because you got to know, like, how it feels and how it, you know, how we hold it and all that.
Did you shred your fingers? Are there scars on your fingers?
No, but it does hurt my little fingers.
You're like, these are writer's hands.
Yeah, my fingertips are so precious and lush. How will I ever type?
How has the reception been?
Good. I was really worried because this is different from the other stuff. And this was a rough book to get out there. Like, I actually went broke while I was writing this book and had a real issues with it. And so I was terrified about this book coming out. And it's very hard on its sleeve. And people seem to be liking it. And no one's written me hate mail yet or tried to kill me. So I'm that's good.
That's good.
Me. It's a low bar.
Yeah, there's one. Low bar. There's one thing that I especially picked up on, which I think you're absolutely great at, and by no means am I like a literary critic at all, but what I love about your characters is the friendships that they make. And that was one of the great things that stood out in my best friend's exorcism, was just the kind of, again, speaking to the kind of authenticity of just how people talk, how, you know, just like how friendships are made. And here, when you get into Chris and Terry's backstory, it feels so rich and real. And so, I mean, like, where does that come from? I mean, I know that's an awful question, but I'm really curious to know where it comes from for you.
I am a really, really inefficient writer. So, like, I over-research everything. My best friend's exorcism, I had, like, TV schedules in my stinky office, like, taped up on the walls from 1988 to make sure the right thing was on TV. Yeah. And, like, I had this big thing where I was like, I wanted a storm to be coming. I'm like, but there was no storm that week. It didn't rain until the next week. And I was like, wait a minute. I could just make it up because no one remembers. But so I over-research. And the other thing I do is I overwrite.
Yeah.
So I sat down and basically wrote the entire backstory of Chris and Terry's friendship, every album they released, every track on every album, how they released it. Where, I mean, there's all these, and it's like thousands and thousands of words. And it's just like so much, and none of it gets in there.
Right.
But I feel like I know that much, so it gives everything more of a sense of authority. I'm like, well, they would never do that because they had that tour in 91 where they got snowed in that town, which is where they spent their money recording this album.
Right.
And on Christmas, they were all drunk watching this movie in a local theater. Like, you know, I know this stuff, so yeah. I can speak to it. So it's just from being really overly stupid about how I work.
And does that cut into, on a frustratingly, you know, kind of basic level, in terms of cutting into your writing time? I'm sure as an author, you're like, okay, do you have like a set schedule? And does that kind of exhaustive backstory writing cut into any of that? What you would consider like, you know, solid writing time, stuff that's actually going to get read as opposed to not getting read.
Yeah, I know. I need to spend more time with the stuff that's going to get read and less of the stuff that doesn't.
But I can imagine there's an author going, there's probably an author listening to this, like, okay, Grady Hendrix. He's like, it's just like, I mean, every author has their own way of going about, you know, books. But
well, my thing is, so my wife's a chef and she owns a restaurant. So she's not ever home. So I can either go home and be lonely or stay in my office and work. I write 7 days a week. You know, I hate these tours. I don't hate them, but they really throw off my schedule. Like, I get all cranky. I'm like one day away from being super cranky right now.
I'm glad we're catching
you. Right on the cusp before midnight. But I write 7 days a week, and I in my office usually by 7 or 8 in the morning. I leave around 5 or 6 or 7, or come back later. So I'm there a lot. You know, this is my job. Like,
yeah.
I'm 45, man. I'm in it to win it. I don't have a backup plan. So.
Well, it's a good time for you now, right now, because you have We Sold Our Souls on bookshelves, and you have a film in pre-production called Satanic Panic.
Oh, that's right.
Directed by Chelsea Peters.
Yeah. For Fangoria.
Yeah. How is that? I mean, I'm sure you can't say too much, but how has the process been so far? Are you excited? You know, what kind of revelations have you discovered along the way?
No revelations so far, but like Chelsea and I have been on the phone, and we've done that sort of, you know, that pass on the script to be like, do we need 2 pets in this scene? We could have 1. Like, does this have to be at night? Could it be in the late afternoon? You know, that all that value engineering.
Yeah.
And she seems really confident, you know, so I'm okay, sure. Yeah. And I'm going down for a table read in early October to make tweaks for dialogue and stuff. But I had a really weird moment at Book Soup, because I was like, after I do these like performances, instead of doing like a reading or anything, and then afterwards people are getting their books signed, this guy comes, I was like, yeah, I read for Samuel, the dad, in Satanic Panic. And so we were talking about him, and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm talking about this made-up person with someone who's going to pretend to be the made-up person that I like sat in my tiny little office, and I'm like, that part's really weird.
Yeah.
And actually, I did that movie Mohawk with Ted Gagan, and Ted had to force me to see it, because I was like, no, I moved on. I don't need to see it. I'm good. But he's like, you're an asshole. Come sit, watch the movie. I was like, all right.
Right.
It was painful, but it was like so, I learned more in that 90 minutes about writing movies than I had in like years.
Well,
like,
I'm curious, what did you learn?
Well, you learned that like, you don't have to, some points you do have to make over and over again, but actually not all of them. Like, I realized, I was like, if one more person pulls out a goddamn map, because I was so worried people wouldn't get the geography in the movie, I'm like, if one more, oh my God, they're pulling out a map, I'm going to throw something at this screen. But then other stuff, I was like, oh, like, I tend to overwrite dialogue, like, I really like speeches. I realized if you get, like, and some actors were like, boom, they could do it. And it was like, it sounded good. And others, like, you could tell they had a tougher time with it, and it sounded like a little clunky. So it's one reason I'm doing the table read with Satanic Panic is like, okay, I can know what actors like to do short and sharp, and I know which actors like to sort of run, and I want to be able to tweak that so it sounds more natural.
What's the biggest difference for you, how you approach writing a screenplay versus a novel, is there a difference? I mean, obviously, structurally, there's a huge difference, but I'm curious if you found a difference in those two approaches.
Well, you know, writing screenplays is hugely good for writing books. Like it taught me so much about structure and like building to an, like getting to an ending and then sort of reverse engineering to that back through. And I love rewriting. Like We Sold Our Souls, there are three completely different versions of this book before I got to this one. Because like I said, I'm not an efficient worker. Screenplays really taught me to be succinct. And that, you know, it's fun to go deep in books and people's point of view and stuff. But when you start getting too abstract about feelings, like, you know, Elmore Leonard has that great quote, like, leave out the parts people skip. And like, it's true, you know. And but the thing about novels that sort of inform screenplays is this thing where I have to have these massive backstories. I just have to. Like, you know, it's otherwise in a screenplay, you have so little time with the characters. Like, there needs to be more stuff behind it, you know.
Much less exposition.
Less exposition, but you need to know what it is so they can refer to it, and it makes it suddenly sound like they have these deep, rich backgrounds.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it helps the actors as well, especially if you're going to be going to set, and the actor's like, oh, you're the writer. Let me pick your brain.
Exactly.
And you've got this kind of arsenal of backstory to help them, you know, boost their performance, maybe.
Yeah. And the other thing is screenplays are harder. Like, I got tricks I can use in a novel that, like, you know, I love lists. I love, like, banging out these paragraphs that are like, bah, have a real rhythm to them. Like, you can't do that in a screenplay, you know? Like, screenplays are a little less vain.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I wanted to circle back a little bit. When you were on last time for the bonus episode, I think Paperbacks from Hell was just about to come out.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then we went out to the Chattanooga Film Festival together, and I caught your Paperbacks from Hell performance.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And I had no idea what it was. I mean, again, you see it on schedule, and you're like, oh, cool. He'll probably just, you know, read a little bit or showcase some books or whatever. But performance is an understatement. What you do is amazing. Like,
oh,
it's
thanks.
Amazing. And I enjoyed the show because you had slides and you have this very energetic, it's like kind of spoken word. It's basically like us when we talk about movies. You're talking energetically about these books and coming up with songs about the title. Yeah. It's like, there's some
terrible
crazy
songs,
shit, but they're great. It was really fun and it made you want to be like, well, now I want to read that. And actually, I went back and got the audiobook because I was like, well, now I want to.
How is the audiobook? I haven't heard.
I haven't gotten to it yet, but I did get the audiobook because I'm like, well, now I need to, you know, do a visual. But anyway, so that came out, and I just kind of wanted to know how much has changed since Paperbacks from Hell came out in terms of, and orchestrating the live show, in terms of those weird little books you found and how now they're so expensive. I feel you're responsible for why they're that expensive.
I know,
now.
Seriously.
I hate me more than you can hate me. Like, I feel so bad. The Voice of the Clown, I had people get in touch. I had one guy get in touch with me and be like, Voice of the Clown I thought was amazing. But also I bought it for $1, you know? And like, this guy bought it for $80 and he's like, he sends me this email. He's like, screw you. You overhyped this book and you only did it because you're selling used copies on the collector market now. And I'm like, you're giving me way too much credit. Like, because I actually thought about, I should buy some copies of stuff. And then when they get, like, if
that's
they get
actually
popular,
genius.
And I was just like, oh, too much work. I'm lazy.
Oh, is it Brian Collins? I mean, he was creating
He's
creating a running list of all these titles. He was just writing them down. And it was funny because I was doing the same thing. And then he would get the jump on me and he'd be like, oh, I just went to this bookstore and got this. And I was like, well, I'm not going to be able to find that.
Well, and it really bugs. And so I'm working with Valancourt, me and Will Erickson and I, who did Paperbacks from Me Good Writer. But we did Paperbacks for Hell together, and so we're doing a line with Valancourt. They've licensed the Paperbacks from Hell name, and we're bringing out, I can't tell what the titles are yet, but we're bringing out 5 of these books with the original covers, just to have them back in print.
And, that's awesome.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about it,
kind of insane.
Like, the guy who bought the $80 book is like, fuck.
Yeah,
fuck
that guy even more.
We wanted Voice of a Clown so bad, and like, we got to the point where we were actually all calling just anyone named what's the author's name? Brown Canary. Sarah Brown Canary, I think. We were calling anyone with that name in like Oklahoma, like, and we just couldn't find her, so we can't reprint the book. But it's really, we're really like we want to undercut that collector's market, because when you find these books for a dollar, they're one thing. When pay $80, your expectations are $80 worth of expectations.
Yeah.
Maybe I've got $20 worth of expectations in me.
We were talking before the show about my obsession with trying to track down Teddy.
Yeah.
And it costs like, you know, $300 or $400 or some ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, we'll never get to read this thing.
The Voice of a Clown by Brenda Brown Canary.
Brenda Brown Canary.
Is currently $90 on Amazon.
That's just ridiculous. It's a really great book. I love it. But if I pay $90 for it, I'd be like, does this dump gold on my lap at some point, you know?
So what are the reissues you're doing? I know you can't tell us titles, but are they going to be the same size, the paperback? Like,
we're looking into that right now, but apparently to get the mass market paperback size, it's actually more expensive than a trade paperback size these days, because everything's trade paperback size, the bigger one. So we're trying to see if we can do it. And Valancourt's great, but like they're a little like Blumhouse in the sense that they will put X into a project, but that's how they survive. You know, they're like, no, we're not going to get all excited and suddenly start dumping more money and that we're never going to recoup, because that's how we go out of business. And so like they're being like, we got to make sure this is cost effective. Like Doogie and Quirk, you know, they'll be like, get all excited and like, okay, well, if we get this printed in like Mongolia, you know, and like we can afford this. But you know, you can't get carried away. And like you're suddenly got a product that's great, but like you're never going to make your money back on it, and then you don't have any more product. So they're trying to be really smart about the way they're doing this, because they want to do, if these five work, five more and five more and five more, which would be fantastic. And we're doing interviews with like the authors to write the forewords and stuff and introductions. So like, you know who they are and like, you know, like and a little bit about them, where the book came from. And we're getting the original art with like the artist's name on it this time and a bio of the artist.
Cool.
Like it's just,
that's awesome.
Yeah. It's going to be fun.
I love that that has spawned other projects and other inspirations. Was it a little bit of a palate cleanser for you to go from Best Friend's Exorcism to that? Do you think you have another one like that in you?
I really want to do one about teen fiction between 1967 with The Outsiders.
Can you please do this?
And Harry Potter in 97.
That's awesome.
It was just teen fiction. Yeah. It wasn't YA.
Right.
And it was weird. Yeah. You know, and like, I would love to do it. It's a lot of reading, but like, someone gives me the money, I'll write that in a heartbeat.
Mm. What about novelizations? Are you a fan of those?
You know, there's someone doing a novelization book, and I like novelizations, but the problem is, like, some are just the movie again. And then they're genius ones, you know, and then they're ones where they're tiny bit different. I did a big piece on novelizations for Film Comment back when they had room for nonsense like that. And it was really fun to do, but I'm not sure I could get a whole book out of it. You know what I mean? Like, but not that someone's doing one, I think.
And there's,
also.
Well, there's a documentary.
Well, our friend's doing a documentary.
Yeah, is that ever going to be done? That thing he's been working on forever.
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't know if I should speak for them. They just did, I think, 2 or 3 weeks of shooting on the East Coast, which I think was the last group of people they really wanted.
I'm really excited to see it.
Me too. Yeah. Wow.
That's cool. Well, I guess we weren't here in the first time you came on, so I guess we have our origin.
Is that just me? We weren't here?
No, I think it was just
I recorded it, I wasn't on mic.
I got a lot of those origin stories. Like, I'm curious, what was the first like horror fiction that you read that like lit your brain on fire? Not just a horror book that you liked, but something that like changed the way you kind of consumed and craved horror.
Well, you know, I wasn't a horror guy when I was growing up. I was scared of the covers. I thought they were like creepy and like dirty. And I was big though on men's adventure fiction, like all that military fiction and stuff. And there was a great book called The Park Is Mine.
That's a movie.
Yeah. And the book is so much more hardcore than the movie. In the book, he kills like 50 cops, you know, and it's like, and he's all addicted to speed and he's like just completely out of his mind. And I must have read that book 100 times between the time I was like 11 and 13. Like, I so should have been sent to a social worker. but that was a book where I was like, oh my God, books can just be awesome. And then I was like everyone else. I read Stephen King as a kid. And then, and I guess what really blew my mind was Clive Barker. Mm. Actually, I got to say, The Raft, the story The Raft and Skeleton Crew, the Stephen King story.
Because
it's
great
it's so bleak and hope. And just, it really just like, I was like, I'm going to read that again because that can't have ended. Yeah, that's horrible. But then Clive Barker's Books of Blood were the ones that really... Right.
For
really
me, it's Damnation Game. When I read that, I was like, oh, wow, this is a different world.
I like Damnation Game, but Weave World, I loved. I don't know why Weave World doesn't have a streaming series. Yeah. Like, that book is a phenomenal.
They've tried.
Yeah, he tried for years.
Yeah. What was the Books of Blood story that just stood out for you?
The Hills, the Cities.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, that was just not, the imagery wasn't like anything I'd ever seen before. Yeah. And one thing with horror is like, part of horror is I'm the guy who wrote an exorcism book and a Sell Your Soul to Satan book. So like, but like you return to old tropes and you redo, but then you get these moments and like The Hills of Cities, it's just nothing you've ever seen before. Yeah, and it just is like, I don't know. It just kicks you into overdrive.
Yeah. There's a great comic book adaptation of that story. Mm-hmm. I think it was in the Books of Blood graphic novel series, and it just brought all of that to life, all these people holding on to one another and all fused together, and it was just like, Jesus. I saw that first and was captivated by the visuals that I went and then sought out the story. It was just mind-blowing.
What was the film scene like in, because we were talking before the show, I went to school in Savannah, and you're from Charleston, they're really close together, a couple hours. What was the film scene like, especially with seeing older movies, or how were you exposed to movies in that town? Was it drive-ins? What was it?
It was mostly VHS.
Okay.
But we had two amazing movie things, which was, there's this old Art Deco theater downtown called the Riviera, and it was closed. And they reopened it one summer to show stuff on 16. And they showed like 2001 and like Creature of Black Lagoon. But when you went in, the place had rotted, and they you couldn't do it now. This was the early 80s. So they put plastic over the seats, so but they were like ferns growing out of the walls, and like there had a big chandelier of vine had grown down and just wrapped around, cool. And the red velvet curtains were all rotten around the screen. And it was,
made all of that up. I'm just, it's too beautiful an image to be real.
They closed it after like a month. Wow. Like, but it was just like, I saw Creature in the Black Lagoon and 2001, which I didn't understand. I was like 10. This is boring. Where's this TIE Fighters? And then the other thing was, we had this place called Stage One, which was this downtown art house that was probably the size of this room, maybe smaller. Everything was on 16. So in the middle of the movie, they'd have to stop to like take off the big built up reels. But I remember I had a girlfriend who was super pretentious, and I really wanted to impress her. And so there was a month when we went to see in a row Female Trouble by John Waters, Tales from the Gimli Hospital, the first Guy Mad movie, and Eraserhead.
Oh, wow.
And those just blew my mind. I was like, what? And it really just punched me in the brain right there, you know, just changed my life.
Yeah.
Otherwise it was the same as you get anywhere, you know, multiplexes, dollar theaters.
Did you see any film production when you were young, or is that, because I know North Carolina obviously had a lot going on, but I don't know about South.
Yes. Are we allowed to use profanity?
Absolutely.
On this? So I was an extra on this thing called North and South. It was a mini series with Patrick Swayze. I think it's episode 2, the plantation barbecue scene. I'm a kid who gets a brief close-up where I fall off a joggling board really badly. Someone had it, and they're like, I want to find your scene. And I saw it, and I'm like, I'm not convincing as a child, even though I am a child. Falling off a joggling board, I just do it terribly.
That's funny.
But the thing was, you had a copy of the book if you were an extra, and it was a big, thick, like, romance paperback, you know, one of those trade paperbacks that's thicker than it is wide. And you got all the actors to sign, because Ralph Macchio was working as, like, first AD then, because he wanted to get into production, and Patrick Swayze and all these people were there, and so and the books just fell apart in the heat, like the glue just melted, and they're just like this mess of paper. And I went up to Patrick Swayze's trailer. I was like, I gotta get Patrick Swayze on my book, you know, he's in Red Dawn. And I'm like and he's like, got his shirt off, and he's like yelling at someone about something. He's like, you know, goddamn, blah, blah, blah. And he turns around, I'm like, Mr. Swayze, what? And I'm like, would you please sign my book? I don't know why I sound like a hobbit. And he's like, God, he's like, fine. Takes the book. He's like, God damn it, this fucking piece of shit is on. What the fuck is up with it? Gift.
Wow.
And he's just like cursing up a storm. He's like, rah, rah, rah. Throws the book back at me. Goes into his trailer. I look at the book. It's like, good luck, best wishes, Patrick. I just called him at a bad time. I'm sure he's a nice guy.
So in terms of career path, what was being an author something that you always wanted to do? Were there other careers that you thought about?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to direct movies so badly when I was a kid. My parents, like, you know, everyone saves National Geographic.
Yeah.
They saved Time Magazine for some reason. And like, we had so I'd read all the film review stuff in it. And I was like, I want to be a director. Now that I've read these interviews with these directors, I totally know about how it works. Yeah. And I didn't. And so I went to NYU, and I was like, well, I don't want to go to film school. And I didn't want to go to like film school or anything, but I was like, I'm going to direct theater. I'm going to direct plays. I was directing plays and writing plays in high school and stuff. Really weird. So we did this one thing called Breakdance Explosion that begins with a scene with Bonzo, the aborting clown. It was really...
Oh, wow.
It was. And then it ended with a version of Hamlet set on an escargot farm. It was just bizarre. And so I was in NYU and I was directing theater and like doing all that stuff. And I realized that most of your time was spent yelling at people to get them to show up on time for rehearsal and to learn their lines. So I was like, okay. I couldn't do movies because it has a lot of equipment. I couldn't do theater because I need other people and other people suck. What's something I can do all by myself? And I was like, well, I guess either writing or art or music. And I'm not musical and I'm a terrible artist. So, okay, writing. And so I just sort of wrote, and I was a journalist for like 10 years. I was like super low paid film reviewer for some papers and stuff. And in 2009, I was like, there's no more journalism. And so I should do something even harder. I'm going to do fiction. I'm going to go for it. And I went to this thing called Clarion Workshop, which was amazing, which really changed my life. Because there's a really weird thing where you apologize a lot if you want to do something creative. You're like, oh, it's not a real job and all this. And this was like 6 weeks with about 20 other people who all took what they did seriously. And if you made fun of it, you're a dick. Mm-hmm. And so like you had to take it seriously and really engage or you got nothing out of it. And I was like, oh, okay, I can do this to some extent. And so that's sort of the weird career path, yeah.
And when did Horror Store come about?
Horror Store came about because I was trying to sell this novel to Quirk called McMansions of the Damned.
Yeah.
And my editor there, Jason Rakulik, read it and he hated it, but he's like, I really like your writing style. And he's like, you know, can we do like a haunted house thing that's updated? Like, you know, like this is, but not this because I don't like this. And I was like, sure. So we were on the phone kicking stuff around and we're like, well, you know, hauntings happen where people are, right? And we're like, so people mostly work. So it's probably a big box store. We're like, what about? And he's like, what about IKEA? And I'm like, oh. IKEA. Yeah. And then he's like, let's make it look like the catalog. And I'm all right. So I, you know, pitched him. He's like, go pitch me that. And I was like, pitch it to him. And he's like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And then for a 5-year period, I worked for, this is weird. Before I was doing journalism, I worked for this thing, place called the ASPR, the American Society for Psychical Research, which is the parapsychological research organization founded in 1885 that Dan Aykroyd based Ghostbusters on. Like Dan and his brother and his dad were all members and stuff.
Where is that based?
New York, right across the street from the Dakota, where they shot Rosemary's Baby. But when I was there, no one else was in the building because they were all usually out doing stuff. And they were doing a lot of research, a lot of academic stuff. So they were always elsewhere. So it was me in the building answering the phone for people calling up and like taking care of the library and archive, which were just amazing.
Yeah.
Did you see the Summerland thing in New Orleans?
No.
But it's this one person show I do, like Paper Axe from Hell, about the Fox sisters who sort of founded spiritualism in the 19th century. And it's sort of, you know, they went from being these sort of country bumpkins from upstate New York to like two of the most famous women in the world, and they basically died in the gutter. It's an amazing story. But yeah, so that sort of also shaped where I went with horror because. I feel like horror is not just scares. It is, but there's also like, it's about death. It's the only genre that sits with death. It's, you know, there's a romance angle to it. There's funny stuff. Like it's so much, it kind of is about everything. And I feel like just limiting it to, it can only be scary. Really, you limit yourself, you know?
Yeah, it's the unknown.
Yeah.
Anything that delves into that tends to end up being kind of in the horror realm, I guess.
Yeah, and also, it's the only genre that's about sickness. Sickness is a big deal. We spend a lot of our life sick. It's weird. It messes you up, you know?
Sadness. Yeah. There's a little level of sadness in My Best Friend's Exorcism that's always stuck with me.
Yeah.
In terms of the kind of the dissolving of friendships.
But those are those high school friendships, right? Yeah. Like, you don't see those people again, but they're so important at the time.
Yeah, I think it's funny, just kind of what I love is everybody, you know, with these books, we're definitely seeing an evolution, just not just in your writing, but just thematically. And Horror Store really stuck out to me and just really resonated with me just based on concept. It's exactly what you're talking about, you know. I mean, I love the characters, but, you know, when the shit hits the fan, I'm just like, now he's really, really leaning into the promise that this book made, you know, and it's terrifying. There's a lot of terrifying shit in it. And then My Best Friend's Exorcism, you know, I just feel like it was just so much more character driven than Horror Store was.
It definitely was.
And then with this, you know, it's kind of a perfect marriage of just, you know, concept and character, and it's playing really well, so I can't wait to finish it.
Well, you know, this book's funny because this was going to be my angry dude book after My Best Friend's Exorcism. Like, I was like, okay, this would be cool. I could do guys. And I was like, you know, because there is that thing where guys, they hold on to being in a band, you know, and it's that sort of World's End thing with Gary King, you know, he can't let go of wanting to be a rock star. And I'm like, what keeps people doing that? And then election night 2016, I went, and the book wasn't really gelling in my head, and I went to this election night party at these friends' house, and it was one of those, I think a lot of people went to that. They were all in for Clinton.
Right.
I was too, and my wife and I got there around 9:30 when things had started to turn.
Yeah.
And what was supposed to be this celebration had turned into just antisocial, despair orgy. Mm. And so, like,
that's your next title, despair orgy.
Antisocial despair orgy. And so my wife and I, like, snuck out. We're like, this is really uncomfortable. Let's just go home.
Yeah.
And I got on the elevator, and I was like, if I'm going to write a book about someone that no one cares about, that the whole world doesn't care about, who basically is treated like they have no value, I'm like, it's only convincing if it's a woman right now. That's only, that is who feels that way right this minute. And like, by the time I got to the lobby, I was like, Chris Belasky, this is her background, this is who she is. Kind of the only time that's ever like kicked in like that.
Wow.
So
that's cool.
And then it took me a year to sort of get my head out my ass and actually get the book right.
If you had to, if you got a chance to make a film based on one of the paperbacks from Hell, anything
in there that you read,
what do you think you would make from that series?
I really think there's an amazing, amazing book to be made. Film to be made out of Ramsey Campbell's The Doll Who Ate His Mother, which is, it's basically just about these people who live in sort of a burnt out neighborhood in England, but they're all like very like, one's doing theater with like street children to teach them like, how to be inspired, and another's a social worker, but this girl's brother loses his arm in a car accident, and this guy steals the arm from the accident site, and they're like, what happened? And they realize someone's eating all the cats in the neighborhood, and then they discover that there's this dude living there who's like, his mom was like a witch and basically warped him. Huh. And he's sort of like this weird troglodyte living in the neighborhood, but it's such an urban, it's almost like Candyman, but like, but it's really, really good. And it's got a couple of twists in it that are fabulous.
It's serious? It's not jokey. It's serious. Ramsey Campbell. Yeah, it's serious. So
although
the cover looks like It's Alive, baby, coming for us. Yeah.
Although I got to say, I'm a huge, huge fan of animal attacks books, and they're just financially not feasible in movies, but I would love to do Slime, which is about killer jellyfish who invade England, and it's like they just float they can't, but like they come out of the taps and stuff, and like they're taking a bath and it fills up with jellyfish. Like I just think it would be the ultimate ridiculous sort of,
we don't have enough of those. I think Becca was talking about one last week, a killer jellyfish movie.
Becca's internal alarm is going off wherever she is. She's just like, wait, someone's talking about Slime. What was the one, James Herbert's Rats. And wasn't there The Fog
right after that?
Those two, double whammy, man, they stuck with me. I was like, I gotta find those two.
Fog is great.
Insane.
The Fog would only be viable as a movie if Kurt Russell was still at his prime to play the main character, who's like just this blue collar guy who doesn't, like, he's just tired of everyone. Like, someone's like, you can't do this, and he just punches him in the face, like he has a meeting with all these scientists, and then he's like, your science is stupid, and he just gets a machine gun and goes out in the streets. Like, it's so good.
Well, we have Kurt Russell's son now, and that's a good reply. As good as we're going to get is Wyatt Russell, I think.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, in Overlord, there is a moment, I was talking about this film that's coming out in November, and, Wyatt Russell has this moment where he's like, I can't do that. And I was like, oh shit, Kurt just like came out. It was like the weird morphing.
There's moments where he really does take him in,
Go.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask, actually, I think it was after you came on the last time, I did a little research. I was like, oh, I'll pick some of the books and stuff. But I found a lot of video of you at the New York Asian Film Festival. and I mean, and obviously you're very, very well versed in Asian cinema. I mean, I love like all the stuff that's coming out of South Korea. I've been keeping tabs on that. I was just curious how, I assume it's from your journalism background, or you said you wrote movie reviews, but how did you get involved with the New York Asian Film Festival?
Well, so when I was in university, like, when you're poor, right? When you're in college, and like, I say university, I'm married to a Canadian. but like,
I also like, you're that with, you're poor.
But and so we lived near Chinatown, and there was a movie theater called the Music Palace. It was this big rotting hall, but it was a $6 double feature, and we're like, $6 for two movies, and you can like take in beers and like smoke in there and stuff. Great. So we got really devoted to it, and like we went in and we saw, the first thing we saw was a double feature of a really ridiculous movie called Always Be the Winner with Tony Leung Chee Wai in it. It was just like this weird gambling comedy. But then afterwards, it was a Stephen Chow movie called Love on Delivery, which is just, and we were like, we want more. And so we just went for years. And when we graduated from college, we didn't know what we were going to do, and I bumped into a friend of mine of ours on the street, this guy Dan, who was Chinese American, but his family was from Hong Kong. And he's like, "Oh, dude, we should all move to Hong Kong together. Like, my sister's there, it's so easy to get a job." And I was like, "Cool." I went home and I said, "Hey, Amanda, we're going to move to Hong Kong." She's like, "Great, we love the movies." And then we lost Dan's phone number, but we moved to Hong Kong and lived there for a couple of years.
She's Canadian, so yeah. We went.
And she had an easy time. I had the worst time getting a job. I wound up selling cleaning chemicals. Like, it was awful. Wow. We lived there for a couple of years. And so when I came back, we would really still love the movie. So we would go, we lived in LA for a little bit, and we would go out to Alhambra and all that and see the Quo Ha Theater and the Garfield, like movies there. And it's just one of those things. And so when the Music Palace closed in 2000, a couple of the white dudes who went there, like, you'd see them and be like, "Don't come near me, you scumbag. Look at you freeloading." Like, you know, on Chinese culture, as you're doing the exact same thing. They got to, like, you know, what can we do? Like, who's going to screen the stuff we want to see? Like, Zhang Yimou, Wong Kar-wai, no problem. But, yeah, like, what about Stephen Chow and, like, Andy Lau movies and stuff? So we all, none of us had film festival experience. We all threw in $1,000 and just started showing them. Like, the first thing we did, and, like, no one knew this stuff. Like, 2000, we did the Johnny Toe retrospective. We just rented the stuff from Johnny and, you know, and just showed the movies at the anthology or somewhere. Well, this was way pre-election. Okay. I think the 99 was his most recent movie, Running Out of Time, and The Mission. And it was a blast. And so we just kept doing it, and it sort of grew. Now, like, 18 years later, it's like up at Lincoln Center, and I just sit on the board and take credit for other people's work these days.
It was fun. Amazing.
And I got to say, the best, and I'm just going to throw this out there. Did you see One Cut of the Dead?
We talked about it earlier on the show.
My favorite movie of the year. Yeah. And I actually did the catalog write-up for Fantasia for that. And they're like, "Hey, we're sending you this Japanese shot-on-video horror movie. It's about a crew shooting zombies and zombies attack." And I'm like, "Oh my God, this sounds terrible." Yeah. And for the first 30 minutes, I was like, it's my favorite movie.
And then the rewards happened about 37 minute mark, and you're like, yes.
It is absolutely, I think, the best movie of the year.
Oh, guys, it's incredibly emotional. Yeah. Like, the second half is very emotional because you got this father daughter story.
Oh, I got weepy at the end.
Yeah, me too.
And do you know what happened to it in Japan?
Huge hit.
Like, word of mouth hit. Like, I'm so happy for that guy. It is such a smart movie.
Was that, I wasn't familiar with the filmmaker. Is he new?
He knew. I think he'd been like an editor or a DP or something for a long time, but this was his first
real. So he's drawing off that hunger that the director in the film actually has, which is, you know, just like that desire to find that one thing that's going to push him out into the spotlight.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
And no, I'm so glad someone else saw that. I think it's amazing.
I loved it so much. What I was going to ask you, what kind of horror fiction are you reading these days, and is there anything that you would recommend to our listeners?
Mostly I'm still reading old stuff. Like, I've been reading a lot of stuff for Valancourt and, like, looking for titles and things.
Right.
I don't read a lot of new stuff, although I really like Paul Tremblay's Cabin at the End of the World. I really did. And, like, you know, it's like there's some bits in it I don't like, but I think it's the best thing he's written, like, writing wise. Mm-hmm. And the ending, I thought, really just stuck the landing. And that's
Right? Like, it feels like you're reading something that's, it's our, what's this collective dream that's happening right now?
Oh, totally.
Or nightmare, rather, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's another book. It's from, I think, 2009, but I recommend it every chance I can get. This guy, Daniel Krauss, wrote this book called Rotters, Rotters.
Hmm. I've had that recommended to me before.
It's a YA book, and I don't know how they got away with it, man. It's basically like a kid, his mom dies, his dad abandoned him. He has to go live with his dad. He hates his dad. And then he discovers that his dad's a grave robber. And there's a contemporary book and, like, you know, digs up corpses, pulls out their gold. And he's like, "That's so cool. I want to learn the business." And it is the most antisocial anger. It is like reading a Molotov cocktail. It's an amazing book.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, this was brought up a while ago. It might have been Becca who...
Becca did bring that up.
Right?
Did she? Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it should not be sold to kids, but I'm kind of glad it is.
Yeah, that's true.
And then I'm going to ask you, why isn't someone remaking The Stepford Wives? I know there was that 2004 remake that was terrible, but like... What the hell? That is like such a movie
that
for now.
That sounds like a TV show, though.
I feel like, it's either like a miniseries or something like that, or like a Westworld-like revamp. I mean, you know, what I think worked well with Get Out is just kind of a distant cousin of Stepford Wives in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's not so much, let's remake Stepford Wives, it's what can we cherry pick idea thematically, you know, and kind of play with.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. I just, you know, Rosemary's Baby so overshadowed that book, and I think it's a terrific book.
Yeah.
I think also a lot of reality TV is doing these Orange County Wives in New York City, and I think it's almost too close. It's like Trump's too easy to make fun of. You don't want to watch stuff with Trump. It's the same problem, I think. listening right now.
I never made that connection. That's awesome.
I always make that connection.
Oh my God, the Real Housewives of Stepford County.
Oh yeah, I would watch that.
That's
your next one.
That's it. Are you already kind of percolating on ideas for the next
one? Oh no, I'm writing the next one.
You're writing
I've
it?
Done
wow.
the first dress coming out next fall, 2019. Yeah, I just finished the first draft and it sucks, so now I'm making it not sucky. But it's not, I don't want to talk too much about it, but it's not a sequel, but it's set in the same neighborhood as My Best Friend's Exorcism, because that's my neighborhood where I grew up. It's about 5 years later. And I realized when I did My Best Friend's Exorcism, everyone was always like, oh, Gretchen's parents are so terrible. And I'm like, well, no, there's a version of this book where here are two parents and the kid's out of control and they don't know what to do. So this is a book about parents and kids and sort of like, I want to try to make the argument that parents really have one job and it's not a pretty one. And it really is, you keep your child alive and safe. And that's not a pretty job, but who else is doing it? And it's necessary. Yeah. And so that's the next book.
Yeah. And when do you become a helicopter parent and also just sit back and let them grow and do their own thing?
Well, and I was just talking to someone whose kid is trans.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, they came out to us about this when they were 18. And they're like, but an 18-year-old's an idiot. And you're like, I've seen you make so many bad decisions. How do I know this is a real... And you've got to trust your kid, but at the same time, this is the kid who had a party and wrecked your whole house when you went out of town for a weekend. And it's like, how do you do that? Yeah. Like, it's really... I think parenting is so crazy hard. Like, and this has been a hard book to write because, like, I don't have kids. And so trying to understand parenting while not being a parent, it's been tough. Yeah, it's been tough.
Yeah, parenting's a despair orgy.
put it on the back of the book.
Yeah. Your kids haven't hit teenage years yet.
Oh, no. Seven is a teenager. That's what's so surprising about seven. They suddenly act just like teenagers. You're like, what the fuck? I thought I had at least four more years. It's awful. I can't stand it. But the four is still cute.
Well, yeah. How do you tell the difference between my kids making a mistake, but they need to make it and learn from it, or my kids making a mistake, and this is a terminal mistake, and I need to keep them from making it? Like, I don't, man, that is hard stuff.
Just imagine how hard it is to lead your own life, how hard it is to try to control another human being's decision. That's basically impossible, but it's not going to stop you from trying poorly.
Yeah.
You know, and so just knowing where to push and where not to. I'm not in the teenage years yet, so I have no idea, but it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Whereas you just skipped into teenage years.
I skipped into teenage years, which is hard to imagine. But I like to think, but the thing is I have the upper hand because I know exactly, very clearly, how I acted as a teenager. So any trick of the trade that she thinks she can get away with, I'm like, I know what you're doing. I did the same thing. Yeah. Don't do that thing.
Yeah.
Like, I understand it. And I know exactly the psychology of why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And it kind of throws her off. It throws her off because she's like, oh, shit. You're going to be tough. You're going to be tough to fool.
Well, I also feel like now, if I had kids, I'd be like, I wouldn't know what to do with screen time. Like, how do you deal with that? Like,
it's that's impossible. Oh. It's so brutal.
Yeah.
Any notion that you have to throw it out.
And the worst is, it's non-narrative. Like, if it was TV shows and movies, I think I'd be cool with it. But it's YouTube videos of some stranger talking to your kid, telling them weird shit, and like going, oh, we're going to open this thing now. And you're just listening to it going, what the hell are you even doing? It actually makes me angry when I hear these weirdos from all over the world talking to your kid. It's super weird. They're the parents now.
Yeah. Well, that was one of my nephews. My sister had such a hard time with him gaming online with like Vent and stuff. She's like, wait, so some total stranger in Omaha is going to be talking to my kid at like 8 in the morning or whenever, you know, on Saturday. Like, what?
And good luck trying to stop it, though. That's the thing. The world just keeps going forward. Yeah. It's bizarre. Well, that sounds
Sometime next year, new book from Grady Hendrix.
September 2019.
All right. We Sold Our Souls. Now out on bookshelves. If you haven't read any of Grady's work, I highly recommend you do so. Horror Store, Paperbacks from Hell, My Best Friend's Exorcism, Souls, out now. Grady, thanks for coming on.
Dude, thanks for having me.
Of course. Come back anytime. We'll get you back here next fall to talk about your new one.
I hope so.
All right, man. Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye, y'all.